beyond the matrix for people who dare to think outside the box of convention. And I'm just back from Egypt, and you can tell by my running the title of my show that I'm still in another dimension. It was an extraordinary, extraordinary journey, another one of the great ones that I've been honored to organize and share with so many wonderful people. So all of my soul family listening in, greetings back from Rome, and you know I'm thinking about you in these days. I will be speaking quite a lot about what occurred in Egypt, regarding also what's happening now with the violence and the really, really difficult situation the Egyptian people are in. And I will also be speaking about the experience I've had with this group, which included having UFO presence respond to my call when we were in an isolated situation in the Temple of Hatshepsut. I know you're going to want to hear about that, so please watch my website and my social media to hear about upcoming interviews. One will be, I will be interviewed on the Occult Network radio program on Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, so you might want to check that out. All righty. Well, we've gotten off to a late start this morning, so I won't take too much more time to get right to the plot, which is to welcome my guest today. I was intrigued by this author. I haven't had a chance to speak with him, and I haven't had a chance to read his book, Pope Annalisa, but it intrigued me, and he was willing to come on at the last minute. So I'm delighted to invite and welcome Peter Canova. He's the author of this book, as I said, Annalisa. Pope Annalisa. For the past 30 years, Peter has researched mainstream and alternative spiritual traditions, as well as the cutting-edge findings of quantum physics, which you all know is one of my passions. As a young man, he experienced direct form of contact with higher information. So he is a kindred spirit, and I'm sure we're going to have an amazing conversation today as we discuss his book, Pope Annalisa, which is, his site is popeannalisa.com, and many other subjects which are near and dear to my heart, as I'm sure they are to you, ranging from feminine, our transition into the yin, the feminine, sacred feminine, and quantum physics, the evolving human species, and whatever else comes up. Hi, Peter. Thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, you're welcome. Good. I guess it's good evening over there in Rome.
Yes, it is. We're an international situation with many timelines. So, where are you located?
Right now, I'm in outside of Boston, Massachusetts.
Oh, very cold there, I hear.
Actually, the weather is fantastic here. It's almost been California-like weather for the last 2 weeks.
Yikes. Okay. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
All right, let's get rolling. I would love to, I want you to know that the whole concept of this book just blows me away. You introduce the concept in a novel form of an African pope into the structure of such demagoguery as the church. So I would really appreciate, before we get rolling onto all your vast wisdom on so many subjects, what motivated you to write this book? And please give us an overview of what the story is really about.
Well, my impetus for writing the book was probably in your biographical introduction. When I was in my 20s, I found out that I was a medical intuitive, and that kind of opened the door to other experiences that I had, clairvoyance, clairaudience, remote viewing, psychokinesis, just a whole slew of things that started happening in my life. And to make a long story short, after I had direct experience of these things, I realized all those things that we had been told in church or about spiritual issues were no longer something I needed to take on faith. I now had direct knowledge of it because I had experience of it. And it really led me on a quest all my life to find out what was really behind all this. What's the energetic connection that exists between all humanity, that I would be able to get the kind of information that I was getting. Let's say, for example, when I was functioning as a medical intuitive, all I would need was a name, age, and address of anybody anywhere in the world, and I would be able to instantly to sort of tap into their medical or psychological problems with a great degree of accuracy. So I realize we must be all part of an unseen energy matrix, which is partly the title of your show. And being the Capricorn that I am, it wasn't just good enough to have the intuitive experiences. I had to really kind of understand a little bit more about the laws and the principles and the operations behind it. So over the course of 25 or 30 years, between my own channeling and between the tremendous amount of exploration and research that I did, I felt I had something to communicate to people to help them get on their own path to contacting higher information and thereby hopefully, you know, improving their lives. And that was really the reason for my writing this book. Now, why I chose to do a fictional novel rather than nonfiction, simply because there are many, many people in the nonfictional field that write about related issues, and they're all doing a good job, and I figured, well, you know, what am I going to add to that? But I've always believed that the best way that we learn is by having the heart and the mind work together, and I could best accomplish that in a novel where I could get these thoughts out, these concepts out, but put it in a very entertaining form that would engage people, and they could really live it and breathe it through the lives of the characters and the action, and see how these people grow in spirit and knowledge, and how their characters arc throughout the trilogy that I've written. And so far it seems to be successful, because I have people that of all stripes reading the book. Some of them are just in it for the read and the action and the adventure and the plot line. Others really get the spiritual content out of it. So that was really my purpose, is to point out some thoughts and ideas to people that may get them thinking about their own spiritual life.
Well, wonderful. And I see that you've won multiple awards for the book. So congratulations for your work.
Thank you.
You've spoken in depth about the ancient mystery schools and their role in preserving the sacred wisdom. And this is, of course, something that I think many of us are eagerly rediscovering and applying in our passage of into, well, let's say, our understanding of pretty heightened esoteric knowledge at this time of transition. Would you like to elaborate on some of the information that you feel is of the most value at this time of transition with regards to those ancient schools of mystery?
Yeah. Well, you know, the mystery schools, really, you can sort of trace the origins of the mystical wisdom, of which the mystery school is one. Mystery schools were one phase of the transmission of that wisdom, probably back 12,000 years and before, with shamanism, early shamanism, which for all the scholarly research seemed to have centered around Siberia, 12,000 BC and prior. But basically, shamanism, very simply, is the belief that two worlds exist side by side. One is the material world that we are used to believing is our reality, and the other is the world of spirit. And the shamans were those who would cross between the worlds. They would essentially communicate, and this is, I guess, another way you could say contact with higher knowledge, and they would communicate with this spirit energy, and they would bring this information back primarily for helping people and for healing people. And the wisdom that was gained by these explorations, these inner subjective explorations to the other side, was a whole lineage that stretched on down through the ages, and the mystery schools, which flourished really probably from about 1500 to, let's say, the 1500 BC to the early centuries of Christianity, were almost like an Ivy League network of academies, and they kept this ancient spiritual wisdom alive, which was primarily an oral tradition. They didn't tend to write things down because they were afraid of it being misused. So kind of like the Freemasons today, people would go through many levels of initiation to gain this sacred wisdom. And unfortunately, with the advent of Christianity, in the Western world, that whole chain of wisdom was broken by the interpretation of the branch of Christianity that won out, which was Orthodox Christianity. And that represented probably the first big break in this chain of universal wisdom in thousands of years. But if you like, we can talk a little bit about what this ancient tradition was that they were teaching.
Yeah, before we delve into that, I'm a little curious. You said, like the Freemasons today, And of course, there is a lot of debate as to the essence of the Freemasons' work. And, you know, there's all kinds of interpretations of what they're up to, and some believe that they're not of the highest intention. Do you have any personal experience that you want to share with us?
Well, not about the Freemasons. That's a subject I'd rather remain neutral on, because it's really not my purpose to talk about them. The way I made the analogy here was really more in the sense that in Freemasonry, you have about 33 degrees of initiation that you have to go through to become a Master Mason. In the ancient mystery schools, you had anywhere from 4 to 10 levels of initiation, where you would gradually be introduced to these to the higher precepts of the spiritual wisdom. So in that regard, it was a staged initiation of a carefully calculated course that was designed to really weed out those people who had the spiritual maturity and the determination, you know, to learn the mysteries of life, as opposed to those who maybe really didn't, really and truly didn't have the mindset to pursue that kind of a rigorous study.
Yeah, I agree. Would you agree that a lot of these souls have reincarnated now to take their position to help in the transition that we're going through?
Well, you know, I really do believe that. Of course, a major theme in the book is that it's called the First Souls Trilogy. Pope Annalisa is the first book of that trilogy. And the First Souls is the saga of the first fall of spirit into material existence. So the trilogy traces the lives of these characters who really are you and me. You can read the main characters or the First Souls as being the story of humanity about our origin, destiny, and purpose, and how they grow in terms of their remembrance of their spiritual home, and how they grow and suffer and struggle through the years to regain that spiritual state that we all once came from, and to help humanity awaken to that state. So it's really kind of an epic story of this titanic struggle to regain the source of our origins. And I personally believe that in that process we grow and we reincarnate and we come back, and those of us who get to a certain point where they have knowledge and they have things that they need to communicate, you know, certainly are there to be helpers and to be way showers to help people along the way, to get them on the path of realization.
Indeed. It's particularly significant to me at this moment, because I've just returned, as I said, from Egypt, and we had the most amazing starseed family, and one recurring experience was so many people feeling this longing, this pull to return to that home. And I think this is one thing that we're struggling with as light workers on this planet now, the knowing that we've come to help rebirth this planet, and assist in this transition, and the longing to return to spirit.
I think it's no coincidence that Pope Annalisa is just starting to gain in popularity. You know, I had to do it initially as a self-published book because it was just too big, maybe a little too controversial, but certainly a lot of it was because of the bad economy that went into, and no one was willing to take a risk on an epic trilogy and a first-time author. But the fact is that the book is starting to take on a life of its own, and right now I'm dealing with about 3 or 4 different groups that want to make a movie out of it. But I think it's no coincidence that the book is here because the old world that we knew is breaking down, not just in Egypt, not just in the Arab world, but even in our country. Institutions are failing. The government is failing us. Their people are suffering greatly right now. And I think that certainly people are looking for a new paradigm. And we always tend to try and solve our problems in the materialistic way by socioeconomic or political means. What Pope Annalisa is trying to show is that there's another dimension to solve our problems, that there's a spiritual solutions that can be very helpful to us, supersede the material way we tend to go about trying to solve our problems, which in a lot of ways just tend to bring us around in a circle.
Yeah, I'm noticing in my work with people that the shift into the yin and the sacred feminine epoch or era that we're moving into is really mutating the experience of so many people. I'm finding a lot of men are really having a struggle with this, and a lot of women are still afraid to go into their power completely. And regardless of the situation of what of the old breaking down, this consciousness is like, okay, we know we're moving toward this, and yet it's just a lot to deal with, a lot to understand and to embrace at so many levels. So it's definitely a most awesome time of opportunity, especially once the fear goes.
Well, you know, you mentioned the sacred feminine, and that's a very interesting topic because I think it underscores a lot of what's happening here. So if I just might for a minute, let me just address that. Because
absolutely,
I think part of what we're going through here is a major evolutionary cycle that has come around. And, you know, when spirit or consciousness first descended into human form, we were closer to the source of our origins, and that was very feminine in nature. That was intuitive. Probably our early ancestors felt their way through the world more than they thought their way through the world. They were more in touch with the spiritual source of their origins. Over a period of time, because of the denseness of this world, we tended to start to identify with the material. But, you know, there were also things that happened. For instance, all of a sudden, you think of it for a second, you're spirit, and now you're in a physical form, and you're subject to all the issues that brings with it. Back in the old days, saber-toothed tigers probably wanted to have you for lunch. You had all kinds of things chasing you around there, and, you know, you had the harsh climate changes you had to deal with. So all of a sudden, you know, you had to start to look at the world and analyze it and understand it and develop strategies in order to survive. Now, that whole process, that analytical process of surviving in a material world we started using the male half of ourselves, that logical, analytical part of ourselves. And over a period of time, that became the norm of our state of mind, of our way of thinking. We started to move away from the sacred feminine or the intuitive, and then, of course, all the political and social ramifications started to fall in. The goddess worship started to become less and less, and you had more patriarchal governments and structures and things like that. And I think what we're experiencing right now is it's cycling around, because, you see, you never get rid of that feminine part of you, because it's one of two parts of yourself. We are all male and we are all female, each and every one of us. And the sacred, the meaning of the sacred feminine, stripping away all the political baloney, all the kind of radical feminist and political baloney that we've gotten into, in its very simple essence, the sacred feminine is the recognition that God expresses itself in a female and a male aspect. And at different times in our evolutionary history, one or the other of these has been more ascendant. So I think we started off more on the female intuitional side, then we went to the male kind of analytical side. And I think what's happening now is it's cycling around. And the sacred feminine absolutely is coming back into people's consciousness, but not to replace the male qualities, like a seesaw battle, like they're forever fighting against one another. But I think the real key to our next phase of evolution is that we've been through these other two cycles, and now we're coming into balance. Now we're coming into the point where we could become whole, complete, actualized human beings by integrating all of these male and female faculties within our own being to become more functional people.
Thank you for that. It's very eloquently put, because indeed, some people still do not understand what we mean when we're talking about the sacred feminine, and immediately jump to the idea of radical feminism, which is missing the plot completely. As you said, the feminine part of every human being, the male part of, is within my, I'm stammering here. The male understanding that part within him is every bit as important as the woman, the female, rising to her power as well. So
we even see this whole polarity reflected in our biological structures, because I think a lot of people are familiar with the whole left brain and right brain hemisphere theory, whereas, you know, the left brain, or what you call the male functions, they tend to use logic. The female side tends to use feeling. Left brain tends to be detail-oriented. Right brain tends to be big-picture-oriented. In the world of left brain, facts rule. In the rules of right brain, imagination rules. But you see, these are all faculties that we need to use in unison. When I put this book together, I channeled a lot of this information using my intuition, but I also did good old-fashioned analytical book research and study. And, you know, you can kind of think of it like this. Take the example of a rocket. A rocket has two basic parts to it. It has the guidance system and it has the fuel. So the fuel is that intuition, that feminine desire to create and understand, that kind of gives the rocket liftoff, and the guidance system is the direction you want to go in. And, you know, without the guidance system, you can get liftoff, but you'll go around in circles. Without the fuel, you'll never get liftoff in the first place. So we really need to use all these faculties in unison.
Indeed. Yeah, I'm with you 100%. I'd love to know how you merge your wisdom and appreciation for quantum physics with your study and presentation of the ancient wisdom and its relevance in this time of change.
Yeah,
pardon me if I have cracks, because I think you also have got a bit of a cold going there.
Yeah, the I think part of it is we're getting a little static on the phone on my end. I don't know if that's if you're hearing me okay, but
no, I hear you.
Okay, quantum physics. You know, that's a subject that we could probably spend a whole show on. So let me try and get it down to the simplest common denominator on how this is related to the ancient spiritual tradition. Probably the most it really has to do with light and the nature of light and what physics has found in terms of examining energy and light. And there's two branches of quantum physics. There's relativistic physics, which was the world of the large galactic planetary scale physics, which was the world of Albert Einstein. And then the other branch is quantum physics, which is the world of the very small of subatomic particles. Now, in the early part of the in the early to mid part of the 20th century, they made some astonishing discoveries on both sides of the ledger. Albert Einstein came out saying E equals MC squared, which is another way of saying that energy and mass are the same substance. They're interchangeable forms of the same substance. And to rephrase that, that matter matter derives from light and dissolves back into light. So what we feel is solid matter really has its origin in light. And quantum physics essentially found the same thing when they really delved into the smallest levels of the subatomic world. Well, what they found out was that there's no such thing as solid particles. Those things like atoms and molecules that we were taught in school that makes up the solid three-dimensional world do not exist at the most fundamental level of reality. What does exist is waves of light that contain all possibilities in them, all potential and all possibilities. It's almost like a beam of energy that's pregnant with all the possibilities that later on become the physical world. Now, at a certain stage, and we won't get into the mechanics of it, at a certain stage, that light energy collapses into point particles and begins to form the solid crystallized world that we know. But basically, they're saying the same thing that the ancients said 3,000-4,000 years ago, which is God is light, and light is the source, and light is the one energy, and it's the source of all that exists in the world. And off of that corollary, we have a huge amount of parallels that we probably don't have time to discuss today, but parallel universes, the holographic nature of the universe, the Big Bang, these are all things that were predicted in many of the ancient texts, particularly in the Gnostic Gospels that were found in Egypt in 1945. The Gnostics were tremendous seers and almost like the scientists of their day, and so many of the theories of modern quantum physics were actually described in the terminology for the culture and language of their time in the ancient Gnostic texts.
And of course, it's a perfect explanation for the body, the human form returning to light. Because if matter returns to light, then by nature of that simple formula, it is much more simple for people to understand that they are immortal beings in the process of shifting between the spirit self and the material self at will. Would you agree?
I absolutely agree, because the foundation, what quantum physics points to, is that the foundation of everything that exists is consciousness, and light is the vehicle by which consciousness expresses itself. Light actually has a mass to it, and that mass, that matter, the photons that comprise light contain information. The one consciousness essentially breaks itself up into numerous points of light or consciousness, which ultimately become human beings, and collectively, these rays of light essentially shape and inform the three-dimensional physical world that we experience. So light and the way light refracts and the one light breaks itself up into different vibrational frequencies, which are the same as, you know, numerous points of consciousness, is also the basis of how co-creation occurs. We hear a lot in New Age circles about co-creation, and sometimes, you know, it almost, you tend to get a little tongue-in-cheek about it. But actually, there is a real scientific basis for co-creation when you start to understand the nature of light itself, and that light is and consciousness is the foundation for the physical world, not the other way around, as materialist science today would have us believe that, you know, matter started first and through a bunch of random collisions of particles, inorganic matter somehow formed organic life, which in turn developed a brain, which in turn developed consciousness. That model, I think, is bankrupt and is in the process of being overthrown by the new findings.
I agree with that. So where does conscious thought or the primal will fit into affecting that light as it is determined to manifest in matter?
Well, again, if light is the source of matter, the vibrations of light, which are governed by the different levels of consciousness, have everything to do with the formation of the world around you. Obviously, a consciousness that's closer to the will or the source of light, the one beam of light, is going to express itself in more beneficial forms than more ignorant forms of expression, which tend to produce much of the suffering of what we call evil in this world.
So how do you, when you say that, that it's closer to the light, what do you mean as far as conscious thought and intention, intention?
Yeah, it has to do with thought. It has to do with intention. It has to do with attunement. You see, the foundation of the ancient spiritual wisdom was that God is the one and only one energy, but that spirit essentially, in order, spirit had being, but it did not have experience. If you think of something that is everything, that's all encompassing, so that there's nothing else but it, that thing exists. It has being. But it doesn't have experience, because experience can only be gained by contrast. Experience can only be gained by seeing a point of view outside yourself. So it's said that in order to gain experience and knowledge of itself, spirit essentially projected itself out into and pushed itself out essentially into other points of consciousness. And it's an interesting process. Say, think, for instance, of a candle, a row of candles. You have the first candle, which is the original source or consciousness. It lights the next one, which lights the next one, which lights the next one, and so on. So they all come from the same flame, but they all appear as individual sources of light. But another interesting thing happened in this projection of spirit outward, which is that if you take the analogy of a DVD and making copies of a DVD, the original DVD has the most clarity. If you make a copy of that, and then a copy from that, and a copy from that, you get copies that have the same essential essence to it, but each copy, as it goes further down the line, each generation, has less resolution and less clarity, you see? And that's sure. The way that we experience the variety of this world, which is that spirit essentially limited its own consciousness in order to create the appearance of other points of view or other beings. And to the extent that we display elements of that original consciousness, we're vibrating at one level. To the extent that we've forgotten, or we're ignorant in the extreme of the source of that consciousness, we kind of vibrate and we produce, you know, quite another set of phenomena. And that's why in this world we have a world of goodness and beauty, but we also have a world of a lot of ignorance and suffering. It's a mixed bag.
In fact, that parallels so much my own work that describes the process of the one light, the flame, and then the sparks emanating from the flame just plunging into the abyss of darkness, and working those sparks being the individual souls, working their way back up in the spiral of light to eventually merge back to the source.
It's the exact same thing we're saying.
Yes, which is nice to be that synchronistic in such a concept. So I'm delighted to speak to you. You're very articulate and very wise. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
And just before I go on, we're talking with Peter Canova. His website is popeannalisa.com.
And we start out talking about that his novel, Pope Anna Lisa, and we're off on my favorite subjects, especially quantum physics. So if you just tuned in, we've still got a half an hour, and you don't want to miss the rest of this show. All right, let's get back to the schools. I'm particularly interested, if you have any sense, as a psychic and an intuitive, about the presence of about Atlantis and going back to that state and that powerful beginning for what I believe is many of the great societies that existed on this, that exist and existed on the planet. What are your feelings about Atlantis and the first wisdom mystery schools that existed there?
Well, I don't really go into
this. I realize that you can't, there's nothing to research, so I'm asking you for your intuitive interpretation.
Mm-hmm. I don't really deal with the subject in the book, but on the subjects of early possible civilizations, Lemuria and Atlantis, I sense that, my own sense is that these were, how could I say this? Lemuria and Atlantis, particularly in maybe the earliest phases, were almost more in the psychic or spiritual realm, hovering around the earth, than they were actual physical manifestations. Because you see, there was an epoch where spirit was becoming ensnared or enamored of the physical world, and the spiritual energies would sort of hover around the planets like the Earth. And I think that there was, like everything else, there was a thought form of Lemuria and a thought form of Atlantis that existed as a spiritual template before it became physical. And then probably in the earliest physical incarnations, we get to that place that I was talking about earlier, where the early spirits that incarnated into physical form were probably able to project in and out of those forms. They were still very close to the spiritual world. They hadn't become hardened, or they hadn't become crystallized in the thought of materiality. But then, according to the ancient legends of Atlantis, there were later on divisions where they called them the Sons of Light and the Sons of what do they call the Sons of Light, or the Sons of Belial, the Sons of Darkness, which was to me an indication that Atlantis then started shifting from that more spiritual vibration to a more material vibration, which ultimately led to the destruction. And was this an actual event? You know, it very well could have been. But like everything else, it almost doesn't matter to me whether an Atlantis physically existed, because just the fact that the story and the legends of it have survived the way they have tells us that there's an allegory in there. There's an allegory of truth, which is that whole shifting and getting lost from our origins into the hardening of a material consciousness, and how that material consciousness, when it runs amok, essentially leads to leads to destruction. Well, isn't that an allegory for the modern world too? I mean, it's an allegory for almost like every age. Just like the story of Christianity, yeah. A lot of people fret over whether Jesus was actually a historical figure. And, I always say, whether he was or he wasn't is probably less important than what the whole Christian story and the message was about, because it's a universal truth. And we can get hung up in the details, or we can try and understand the message. So I kind of look more at the message of Atlantis itself and the story of Atlantis and Lemuria rather than, trying to define whether it was actually a continent that existed somewhere and got sunk.
And it definitely is a paradigm of what we are now experiencing. Exactly. This is I have one of my books is entitled Atlantis Rising, The Struggle of Darkness and Light. And it proposes that we are again at that pinnacle of the fall of Atlantis. And are we going to let this happen again or not? This is the question that I'm sure many people are pondering at this time of definitely difficult existence on the planet.
Well, I wasn't aware you were doing that, but once again, we kind of find ourselves on a similar wavelength.
Yeah, no, that's a book that I've done about 8 years ago. Maybe we can exchange books when we're at the end of the
that's
hour.
Right.
Yeah. So I've gotten off the track. We were talking about quantum physics, and
I was going to ask you some examples of how you relate quantum physics to some of the ancient wisdom, but I think you've already done that pretty much well.
Yeah, I mean, there is one other aspect of quantum physics that we can probably cover that I think is pretty interesting, and that's the holographic nature of the universe. We can talk a bit about that if you'd like.
Yeah, let's do that. That's my...
Okay. Well, let's first understand how a regular hologram works, and let's think of Princess Leia on Star Wars, where, you know, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're my only hope, and we see that little three-dimensional image of Princess Leia. That is a hologram. And the way a hologram works is that when you take a beam of light, in this case a laser, and you take a single solitary beam of light and it splits, you split it. And let's say the second beam from the original goes off and it reflects off an object. Let's call it an apple, for instance. And so that light, that beam of light reflects off the apple. Now, the original beam kind of loops around and it merges with the light that is reflecting off the apple or an object, and those two now separate beams of light actually merge in a kind of like a crisscross pattern. They form what's called an interference pattern. And the easiest way to visualize this in your mind is to think of throwing two pebbles in a pond, and the ripples come out from each pebble, and at some point they intersect, the waves intersect, and they kind of, you know, ripple together. That's what an interference pattern is. It's when the waves of light from the two beams crisscross and merge together. And then that is reflected onto a photographic medium or a plate, and essentially it shows the image of the apple in three dimensions. And the really cool thing about a hologram is that you can take any part of that holographic image, any fraction, any minute part of it, and it will always contain the image of the entire hologram, the image of the entire apple. Now, what's really interesting about this is that this is exactly how the ancients described the how the universe works. So if we take the idea of a hologram and we extrapolate it out on a cosmic scale, it gets back into what we talked about, that there is one light or one energy, which you can call God, spirit, consciousness, whatever you're comfortable with. And this one light breaks itself up into numerous points of light. So it splits itself, essentially. And let's make it simple. It splits itself into a secondary beam, and that goes and it becomes a soul consciousness. It becomes a light of the soul or a soul consciousness. And then you have the original light, which is the sustaining light, the underlying energy of everything, which is the original beam. And it comes around and it mingles and it reflects with the light off of the soul consciousness. And the interference pattern that's formed for that essentially projects out into the three-dimensional world. So you have an exact analogy of what the ancients were saying reality was, which was a combination of individual consciousness or our soul consciousness co-participating in forming the ideals or images that make up the 3D world. You can call them archetypes. We participate in the formation of the light archetypes, and then we project those on to through a process. It's projected out, and it becomes this 3D material world that we're talking about. And quantum physics and science has a name for this. It's called the holographic universe theory, and it's becoming a widely accepted theory of reality to the point where it was on the cover of New Scientist magazine, and it had a picture of a person with a light beam behind it saying, "You are a hologram." And it's saying that, you know, essentially that, you know, if you can picture it this way, our world is, our 3D world is almost like papered with squares of two-dimensional information. Each of these squares is projecting out light, and that light essentially forms the three-dimensional world. Again, exactly what the Gnostic texts were saying, which is that we have spirit consciousness that blankets this world and projects its essence into this world to form, you know, the world itself. Now, they called that information angels. It was like essentially angel consciousness working along with the, you know, the one consciousness, and they all kind of merged their frequencies of light together to form the world. And that is exactly how the scientists are picturing the operation of the holographic universe. It's really fascinating.
It's very fascinating, and I always invite people to consider that the expression "God made man in his own image" could very possibly signify that the universe is actually, we are cells to the universe, just as the cells are the minutia of our makeup as physical beings. And wouldn't it be interesting if the universe is actually shaped as in a human form, or what we perceive as a human form, and that we are in fact the cells of that form?
Yeah. And you know, it's really the details of the analogies get extremely interesting, because you can take Plato's famous example, the allegory of the caves. For those mm-hmm. of you who aren't familiar with that famous allegory, Plato said, look, human beings are like people that are chained in a cave facing a wall one way, and there is a light behind them. So the light projects onto them, but they can't see the source of light because they're chained just facing the cave wall. What they do see is the shadows that are on the cave wall, and they perceive the shadows as reality because they don't really understand the real basis or the light behind it, so they just see a shadow projection of reality. And the ancients essentially said that, you know, that what we perceive as reality in this world, every single object, a tree, a dog, or whatever, actually exists as an archetype. It exists as a light frequency before it becomes gains the appearance of physicality. It exists first as kind of like a blueprint of light, a template for that particular object, and through various means it pictures out as a three-dimensional object. But Carl Jung's whole theory of archetypes was based so closely on the work of the ancient Gnostics. The parallels even astounded him when he rediscovered the Gnostic text, that they were essentially talking about these archetypes. And science now is saying, listen, we have to start revising our whole nature of three-dimensional objects, because these don't have existence in and of themselves. They have to exist first as light images. Why? Let's get back to Einstein and the others. Because the source of matter is light. So everything that appears and originates as matter starts as light first, which means that dog had an image or a blueprint or a light image template of a dog in an actual dimension that has reality to it, and that we as the mediums of light project those images into three-dimensional reality. Now, I know it's kind of a mind-blower, and it sounds like really far out there, almost sounds like science fiction, but this is actually what quantum physics is telling us today, and it's the same thing the ancients were telling us.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that the audience listening today will not think this sounds like science fiction, because we are pretty much all on this page and exploring and elaborating so many exciting concepts. And no question that the information that's coming to us now from quantum physics is going to really help humanity take that quantum leap. Oh, quantum leap. What a little pun. So what was I going to ask you? I just lost my train of thought.
You could ask me anything your heart desires.
I know, this is fun. I'm enjoying having someone of your caliber on the show. I just love the idea of pressing ourselves to challenge all the old paradigms, and even the question of dimensions, which is something I'm about and as a channel, and obviously you are too. And one of the really important questions that people are facing or asking now has to do with moving out of the third dimension and anticipating or contemplating other dimensions and how we will exist in them. And I remind people that we are multidimensional beings. It's not like we're leaving a dimension to go to another. We are simply capable of being in many dimensions all the time. We do this when we dream. We do this when we think. I'm sure you'll agree with that.
One interesting way to look at this is that don't think of those dimensions as places. Think of them as states of mind, because that's what dimensions really are. What moderns call parallel dimensions, the ancients called levels or dimensions of consciousness. And we are multi-dimensional beings. And my personal belief is that, you know, we exist in different phases of consciousness at many levels, all the way back to the throne of the source. And that when we do contact higher information in many regards, what we're doing is we're contacting a higher vibration of ourselves. so that you know, parallel dimensions or traveling to other dimensions is really a matter of letting your imagination, that feminine part of you, take the lead, because imagination is not fantasy. Don't make that mistake. Imagination is the gateway to higher perception. Because by imagination, you allow yourself to think outside of the box that you have put yourself in. You put yourself in a box where you think that the three-dimensional solid world is exactly what it is. That's reality. It's not. It's a projection. It's a shadowy projection of another reality. And to the extent that you can use your imagination to get outside that state of mind or that way of thinking, you start to open up the doors to the other information and the other states of mind or the other dimensions, and you're able to actually bring back information that can have a lot of analogs in our own world to prove it out. Now, many of the things that I talk about, because I am a Capricorn, I like to see practical spirituality, that spirituality can picture itself out in our lives and, you know, in this dimension. So I usually don't talk about anything that I haven't actually had an experience of at a higher dimension, but then it materialized in my own life. I try and restrict most of the things I speak about to that, rather than things that I don't feel like I can prove to somebody on a three-dimensional basis.
Mm-hmm. I always wonder why more people don't have the opportunity, or the schools to provide more opportunity for people to work with microscopes, because there's no better way to help people understand their own non-physicality as they perceive it than to have them put some tissue in a microscope and see what's going on at the microscopic level.
Well, you know, your own body is a collection of consciousness. Each of your cells has a consciousness in it. I mean, they've literally proven in a number of experiments, very practical experiments, that cells retain consciousness and they're able to receive information. And of course, you know, let's say one of your liver cells may not be conscious that it's part of an organism called a human, but it is part of that consciousness. It is part of that human consciousness. Kind of the same way, like we are cells in the body of universal spirit, and sometimes we don't recognize that, unless we, you know, get to that point where we really get out of the box. But you know, we are cells in the organism that is universal spirit. So as it is above, so it is below. It works the same way on our own bodies.
Yeah, and using the example of the liver cell, on the other hand, that might not be the case, that it's not, that it's aware of its own body, because of the entire body, because we've heard so many stories now of people who have had transplants, and the receivers of the organs begin to change their personalities. A famous story about a woman who was a yoga master and a holistic vegetarian and received the heart of a convict who had been killed, and who was a drunk food eater and all that goes with it, and her personality started to transform. So she began eating McDonald's and just generally changing her entire lifestyle. So obviously the entirety is encoded in every cell of the being.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's not New Age fantasy. This is
no.
Something that, if you really want to look for the information about this, can be scientifically shown.
Yeah, and even if you're not looking at the spiritual aspect of a cell, it's also wonderful for children to look into a microscope, and to see that tissue is actually what they believe is their skin or their finger is really a thriving world of bacteria and every kind of microorganism.
Yeah, and it's a great way to help get the concept through to people that, you know, so it is in that regard. And that's the way we have to look at the spiritual world. I mean, you know, we're sort of like those cells that someone could look at under a microscope, and, you know, we really have very much to do with the, you know, with the spiritual world itself. I mean, human beings, really, if you want to really get down to what we're all about, we're really the fingers of God touching this world. And our purpose here is to spiritualize the material and bring the experience of the material back to the spiritual. We're bridges. That's why we were created. That's why we were projected That's our purpose. And to the extent that we become clear channels to effectuate that bridge is where, you know, how we try and enlighten ourselves or how we try and raise our consciousness.
And that's a beautiful thought. And we have just a few minutes left, so I would like to ask you this question. Do you feel that we are going to reach that critical mass, if it can so be called, where the intended, the light intended will raise the vibration of the mass and take this earth into that next shifted, well, whatever you call, perceive as the shift or the enlightened earth? Do you perceive us reaching that mass, that quantum mass?
You know, I do. I think that absolutely none are lost in the sight of God, and I think that we were, it may not come, you know, in the easiest manner in the world sometimes. This world is a, you know, kind of boot camp, essentially, and it's not, no one said it was going to be easy. But I do believe that that's the ultimate destiny of humanity, is that we will regain our where we came from, because I don't think we can ever lose where we came from. There's a part, what we can lose, what we can lose is certain aspects of the ego and the personality that can be stripped away, because the world of psyche and, you know, is a little bit different than the world of spirit. But there's an eternal part to us that really can never be lost. And to the extent that's the part of us that becomes, that shines, that becomes more prominent in our lives, to reach that critical mass you're talking about, I absolutely believe that that's where humanity's headed. I can't give you a time frame on it, but I do believe that's where we're headed.
Well, that's good for me. I believe that's where we're headed too. And I would like to just, in closing, tell you that you are truly a kindred spirit. And I look forward to more exchange with you, because I have to say we're on the same page here. And I have loved having you on my show. So thank you for being with me.
I appreciate it.
All right, people, you've been listening to the wonderful Peter Canova. His book, again, is, oh my goodness, Annalisa, Pope Annalisa. I knew I'd get it wrong. And his website is popeannalisa.com. I think you're going to want to read this book. I certainly am. And I want to thank Peter for coming on and sharing such synchronistic information as that I hold in my heart. So thank you for tuning in to Beyond the Matrix. That dares you, and I think you've seen it today, to leap out of the box of convention and soar with the eagles in the free thought zone and rise in your spirit and celebrate all that you've come to do and all that will be done. This is Patricia Corey signing out. Nanu, nanu. I'll be back with you in 2 weeks. Thank you for tuning in to Beyond the Matrix.